"My lines may have died, but their truth has not," he said to Burton. He waved his hand to indicate the hills, the river, the mountains, the people. "As you may see if you open your eyes, and do not persist in the stubborn myth of yours that this is the handiwork of men like us," he continued, "or grant your premise, it still remains that these ethicals are but doing the work of their creator." "I like better those other lines of yours," Burton said. "Dull soul, aspire, thou art not the earth, mount higher, heaven gave the spark, to it return the fire." Collop was pleased, not knowing that Burton was thinking of the lines in a different sense than that intended by the poet. Return the fire. That meant somehow getting into the dark tower, discovering the secrets of the ethicals and turning their devices against them. He didn't feel gratitude because they had given him a second life. He was outraged that they should do this without his leave. If they wanted his thanks, why did they not tell him why they had given him another chance? What reason did they have for keeping their motives in the dark? He would find out why. The spark they had restored in him would turn into a raging fire to burn them. He cursed the fate that had propelled him to a place so near the source of the river, and so close to the tower, and in a few minutes had carried him away again, back to some place in the middle of the river, millions of miles away from his goal. Yet if he had been there once, he could get there again. Not by taking a boat, since the journey would consume at least 40 years, and probably more. He could also count on being captured and enslaved 1,000 times over. And if he were killed along the way, he might find himself raised again far from his goal and have to start all over again. On the other hand, given the seemingly random selection of resurrection, he might find himself once more near the river's mouth. It was this that determined him to board the Suicide Express once more. However, even though he knew that his death would be only temporary, he found it difficult to take the necessary step. His mind told him that death was the only ticket, but his body rebelled. The cell's fierce insistence on survival overcame his will. For a while, he rationalized that he was interested in studying the customs and languages of the prehistorics among whom he was living. Then honesty triumphed, and he knew he was only looking for excuses to put off the grim moment. Despite this, he didn't act. Burton, Collop, and Goering were moved out of their bachelor barracks to take up the normal life of citizens. Each took up residence in a hut, and within a week had found a woman to live with him. Collop's church didn't require celibacy. A member could take an oath of chastity if he wished to, but the church reasoned that men and women had been resurrected in bodies that retained the full sex of the original, or, if lacking on earth, supplied here. It was evident that the makers of resurrection had meant for sex to be used. It was well known, though still denied by some, that sex had other functions than reproduction. So go ahead, youths. Roll in the grass. Another result of the inexorable logic of the church, which, by the way, decried reason as being untrustworthy, was that any form of love was allowed as long as it was voluntary and did not involve cruelty or force. Exploitation of children was forbidden. This was a problem that, given time, would cease to exist. In a few years, all children would be adults. Collop refused to have a hutmate solely to relieve his sexual tensions. He insisted on a woman whom he loved. Burton jibed at him for this, saying that it was a prerequisite easily, therefore cheaply, fulfilled. Collop loved all humanity. Hence he should, theoretically, take the first woman who would say yes to him. "As a matter of fact, my friend," Collop said, "that is exactly what happened." "It's only a coincidence that she's beautiful, passionate, and intelligent," Burton said. "Though I strive to be more than human, rather to become a complete human, I am all too human," Collop replied. He smiled. "Would you have me deliberately martyr myself by choosing an ugly shrew?"
"I think you more of a fool than I do even now," Burton said. "As for me, all I require in a woman is beauty and affection. I don't care a whit about her brains, and I prefer blondes. There's a chord within me that responds to the fingers of a golden-haired woman." Goering
took into his hut a Valkyrie, a tall, great-busted, wide-shouldered 18th-century Swede. Burton wondered if she was a surrogate for Göring's first wife, the sister-in-law of the Swedish explorer Count von Rosen. Göring admitted that she not only looked like his Karin, but even had a voice similar to hers. He seemed to be very happy with her, and she with him. Then, one night, during the invariable early morning rain, Burton was ripped from a deep sleep.